that trained quartet was like a piece of ordnance. You know, it was like explosive. You know what I mean? So you had both of those things. You had the serenade, the lyricism on one hand, and then you had somebody shooting bombs.
Coltrane's saxophone sound was the sound of somebody screaming at the top of their lungs, but controlled with perfect poise and perfect elegance. And I think it's that tension that makes it so unbearable and makes it so moving.
He could handle a ballad so tenderly, so softly, so beautifully, yet he had a thunder about him, a power in him, a strength that was just beyond belief.
When you single out innovators in jazz, John Coltrane's name is always near the top of the list, along with Miles Davis, Louis Armstrong, and Charlie Parker. The music he crafted, starting in the 1950s, remains the definitive sound of modern jazz. I'm Nancy Wilson, on this edition of Jazz Profiles, part two of our tribute to Train, saxophonist John Coltrane. John Coltrane created one of the most distinctive sounds in jazz, with cascading layers of notes in the classic sheets of sound. It influenced virtually every saxophonist who followed him. For some, John Coltrane blew the music of ecstasy, like a revival meeting, but others called it anti-jazz. He developed a music free of rhythmic and chordal structures, but he could also turn out the most tender ballad or prayerful him. John Coltrane bloomed late in his career, paying his dues and honing his skills in a Philadelphia jazz community that made a culture out of technical virtuosity. Alto saxophonist Jimmy Heath, one of Coltrane's oldest friends.
I think we were studying it at that time because Charlie Parker and Dizzy laid down some heavy music, man, and you had to study that to play it. That wasn't any off the top of my head kind of playing. You had to know what was going on.
He had a classic apprenticeship.
Writer Amiri Baraka covered the new jazz in the 1950s and 60s under his birth name, Leroy Jones. He says Coltrane's musical education began in the Methodist Church, where his grandfather was a minister.
Got into the church music thing, which is always a kind of link to Afro-American music, is the church. And then he started playing the rhythm and blues stuff. He was in the Navy band. Then he went to Philly playing, and on bars, walking the bar and all of that kind of, funky stuff. He was with Dizzy's Big Band, which was a great big band.
John Coltrane playing in the Dizzy Gillespie Big Band. After working with Dizzy, Coltrane's reputation blossomed, performing with pianist Thelonious Monk and making landmark recordings with Miles Davis, including Kind of Blue. With a grounding deep in the roots of jazz, John Coltrane made his first definitive statement in 1959 with his album, Giant Steps. It spawned the jazz standards Mr. P.C., Naima, named for his first wife, and Giant Steps. Giant Steps proved to be a prophetic title. John Coltrane stepped over into a new sound for jazz, making the tenets of bop and Miles Davis's modal moods his own. But it was only a prelude to a band that the saxophonist put together in 1960. The John Coltrane Quartet became one of the most legendary groups in jazz, standing alongside Louis Armstrong's Hot Five, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and the Miles Davis Quintet. Amiri Baraka says the Coltrane Quartet quickly became the premier ensemble of the day.
The two major bands would have been Miles Davis, and the other one would have been Max Roach and Clifford Brown. Until, the Trains band then arises, with that kind of... Then that became another kind of star quality band, at least for the Diggers.
Looking for a pianist, Coltrane revisited an old friend, McCoy Tyner.
I was working with Cal Massey, and Cal had written Fiesta for Charlie Parker. He was a composer, and he played a little trumpet, And I was in Cal's band, and John and Cal used to practice together. And I heard about John, I heard his early prestige stuff and the early Miles Davis things. So we were playing at a place called the Red Rooster at the time. And he invited John to come to meet us. I was about 17 years old. And then we became friends, and I used to hang out with him, go over his mother's house and sit on the porch. That was when he was writing Giant Steps and Countdown and all those tunes.
For his drummer, Train tapped Elvin Jones, a musician he'd worked with in the Miles Davis group when Elvin subbed for Philly Joe Jones. Lewis Porter, author of the 1998 biography, John Coltrane, his life and music.
As far as Elvin Jones, it was his power, his energy, his polyrhythmic style, because it sounds like there's a lot going on at once. Sometimes sounds like more than one drummer at a time. Elvin Jones, Coltrane felt, was somebody who shared his level of energy and creativity, who could not only keep up with him, but push him.
Initially, Philadelphian Steve Davis, then Reggie Workman, held the bass chair. But the quartet became firmly anchored when Jimmy Garrison took over sole possession.
What Garrison would do is not only contribute a solid walking bass line, which a lot of people know he did, but if you listen closely, he's doing a lot of other things. He breaks up the rhythm. He leaves spaces in the rhythm. He does a lot of interactive things. But what Coltrane liked about him is that even if he broke up the rhythm, there was still a solid sense of where the time was.
The John Coltrane Quartet captured the jazz zeitgeist with their album My Favorite Things. Recorded in 1960 with bassist Steve Davis, it set the stage for the next 5.5 years of Coltrane's career. And the choice of a lead song couldn't have been more unusual. Jazz musicians have frequently reinvented popular tunes, but everyone was thrown by this selection.
Cream-colored ponies and crisp apple strudels, doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses with...
My Favorite Things was one of the popular songs from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, The Sound of Music. McCoy Tyner.
John says, well, I see what you think about this song. And I mean, I'd heard it because it was from The Sound of Music. You know, it was a very famous song. Yeah. So I was wondering, what are we going to do with this?
My Favorite Things was the first song in which Coltrane explored a more open modality. It's a sound with very few chord changes, giving the soloist a more expansive landscape on which to improvise.
It was almost like it was trance-like, and it gave him a harmonic cushion. You know, he could do what he wanted to do. It wasn't anything restrictive in it.
John Coltrane playing My Favorite Things. This was the first time Coltrane had put down his tenor saxophone to record on soprano. Up until then, the soprano had been a minor instrument in jazz. But My Favorite Things changed that. Elvin Jones.
Selmer Music Company and King and all of these companies ought to be, you know, they should put a statue in Washington, D.C. next to the Washington Monument. Because everybody that ever heard Coltrane, if they played a reed instrument, they went out and bought a soprano saxophone. And so that's the effect that he had.
In a rare 1966 interview, Coltrane spoke to writer Frank Kofsky in a car parked at a noisy supermarket. Coltrane said the soprano saxophone opened up new possibilities of expression.
The soprano, by being this small instrument, I found that playing the lowest note on it was like playing one of the middle notes in the tenor. I found that I would play all over this instrument, you see.
John Coltrane with Blues to Bechet, paying tribute to one of his inspirations for the soprano saxophone, Sidney Bechet. You're listening to Giant Steps and Beyond, part two of our portrait of saxophonist John Coltrane on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. While John Coltrane was reaching a popular peak with his quartet, his 8-year-old marriage to Naima Coltrane was hitting low notes. Louis Porter.
I think one of the problems that Coltrane had with Naima is that she was not a musician, and there was a point where she actually resented his being away from home and touring all the time, and the amount of time that he practiced, which was practically every minute that he was awake.
Coltrane had already moved out of the house when he met the future Alice Coltrane in 1963. Already an accomplished musician, the former Alice MacLeod was playing piano with vibraphonist Terry Gibbs. John and Alice instantly recognized each other as soulmates.
It was an immediate one. John was very beautiful. He had a way about him that you really had to sort of surmise his thoughts or his feelings. He wasn't outgoing at all. Like, he was just a very subtle in nature, very pensive, very full of thought, which I admired it greatly.
Alice began traveling with the quartet, and although she wouldn't play with them for some time, Train was already augmenting the group with other musicians, among them alto saxophonist Eric Dolphy. Dolphy played on many of Coltrane's recordings, including Live at the Village Vanguard and Africa Brass. Although Coltrane's quartet was a popular group, it was also attracting criticism for the long solos, sparse structures, and aggressive style. Downbeat magazine called his music anti-jazz. Train was so struck by the attacks that he and Dolphy countered with an article explaining their new music. In an interview with Leonard Feather, Dolphy defended his friend.
I know from listening and working with him that he is... he plays so much, and he has a big, as we say, a bag of ideas that he has. He'll play long sometime and he can play long anyhow. He has essential things that he can go through, but sometimes he'll get inspired at that moment, yeah. And he'll carry himself over. We'll be right back.
John Coltrane, recorded in 1961 at the Village Vanguard, playing Impressions with Eric Dolphy on alto saxophone. Coltrane was a voracious listener and was hearing sound well beyond the jazz spectrum. He was inspired by folk music sources from Spain to the Deep South. Olé is from a Spanish revolutionary song called El Vito, and Spiritual was derived from Nobody Knows the Trouble I See. For Dahomey Dance, Train turned to Africa.
Yeah, we were very heavily into ethnic approaches to music.
McCoy Tyner.
When we did Dahomey Dance, that was it was a recording that he had of these guys using their voices like drums. And they had this rhythm, and that set up the bass line for Dahomey Dance.
John Coltrane's Dahomey Dance from the 1962 album Olé. John Coltrane also began looking east. He was drawn to Indian spirituality and the teachings of Hinduism. And he was also enthralled by the music, especially that of Indian sitarist Ravi Shankar. Coltrane sought out a meeting in New York City in the early 1960s. Ravi Shankar.
We met 5-6 times, spent a lot of time. He was so interested in learning Indian music. I taught him the rudiments of our ragas and the way we improvise. He was so interested to know how we can create such peace, you know, that feeling of tranquility in music.
Coltrane admired Ravi Shankar so much that he named his second son, saxophonist Ravi Coltrane, after him. The open-ended improvisational forms of Indian ragas inspired Train to further simplify the chordal structure of his music. His composition, India, had only one chord, played with the Indian string drone instrument called the tambora.
He brought the tambora in because tambora had a sound of own.
Alice Coltrane.
A sound that's a perpetual one, a sound that doesn't end. So I knew that that was one of the reasons that he wanted tambora, because once the sound starts, it seems to play upon its own chords like a sympathetic vibration. It was a great ambience created from that.
The Indian motifs also changed the way the other musicians in the band played, especially McCoy Tyner, who had to find a different approach to the piano.
You couldn't really sit there and play chords. I mean, you know, you couldn't do that. It was about sound. Sometimes I play two notes, you know, an interval, you know, and it may be in octaves, you know what I mean? So if that was the sound that was what was needed to set the mood, that's what kind of thing I had to come up with.
Quartet drummer Elvin Jones.
It was a perfect opportunity to expand one's imagination, you know, because one chord doesn't lead you very far. But imaginatively, it can go, in any direction you choose.
Thank you. the John Coltrane Quartet playing India at the Village Vanguard in 1961. John Coltrane was already shattering the boundaries of jazz, challenging and enthralling critics and listeners alike. He would stretch further still, but not before returning to his roots and recording with a jazz icon. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to Giant Steps and Beyond, part two of a portrait of saxophonist John Coltrane on Jazz Profiles from NPR National Public Radio. With albums like Giant Steps and My Favorite Things, John Coltrane had already established himself as the leading saxophonist of his generation. He'd also added a few volumes to the library of jazz standards. At the same time, his modal approach, intervallic leaps, and long solos were triggering equal amounts of acclaim and criticism. But at the height of the controversy, he recorded a set of ballads and cut a recording each with singer Johnny Hartman and legendary composer Duke Ellington. Coltrane was accused of caving in to label pressure to make a more commercial release. In a 1966 interview with Frank Kofsky, Train admitted the albums were the idea of Impulse Records, but he defended them to the end.
These ballads that came out were definitely ones which I felt at this time, and I chose them. It seemed to be something that was laying around in my mind from my, you know, youth or somewhere that I just had to do. And the Johnny Hartman, I just felt something about him, you know, I don't know what it was. And, I don't regret doing those things at all.
My heart sing like an April breeze on the wings of spring, and you appear in all your splendor, my one and only love.
John Coltrane and singer Johnny Hartman with My One and Only Love. In 1964, John Coltrane recorded an album that many consider a classic of modern jazz. It took the spiritual yearnings that had been part of Train's life and put them in the forefront. A Love Supreme seems to emerge out of the silence of contemplation. Alice Coltrane says that's exactly how it was composed.
That was very beautiful because he went into isolation for about maybe 4 or 5 days. But he stayed up there and he fasted. And when he came down stairs, he told us that he had completed the entire music of his next album. He said, it is a Love Supreme. He said, and I have everything.
Love Supreme ends with a movement called Psalm. Coltrane biographer Lewis Porter.
What Coltrane's doing in the last section is remarkable. He had taken the poem that he'd written in the liner notes, he had memorized it, and he was reading it musically on the saxophone, syllable by syllable. A love supreme, I will do all I can to be with you, O Lord. Reading it on the saxophone. And when he gets to the end of the poem and says amen, that's the end of the recording.
The John Coltrane Quartet, playing, or perhaps praying, on A Love Supreme. While Coltrane was expanding his spiritual consciousness, he was also getting more expansive on his saxophone, an approach fueled by the burgeoning avant-garde jazz scene. Coltrane admired the free excursions of Sun Ra, and especially Ra's tenor saxophonist, John Gilmore. In a 1981 interview, John Gilmore remembered Train coming to hear him play.
I had a different rhythm concept than he had ever heard anybody else play. And that's what intrigued him when he heard me play against this group, Willie Bobo's group, one night down in Birdland. Well, what really happened, I couldn't play with them, so I had to play against them. I couldn't play with them. So I played some stuff that was counter to what they were doing, and it worked out perfectly. And it shook Train up, you know, it shook him up. Yeah, it shook him up. He came running from the back of Birdland screaming.
John Coltrane.
I listened to John Gilmore kind of closely before I made Chasing the Train, too. So some of those things on there are really direct influences of listening to this cat, you see.
John Coltrane playing Chasing the Train at the Village Vanguard in 1961. Train was also influenced by the iconoclastic alto saxophonist Ornette Coleman and made an album called The Avant-Garde with Coleman's group. Ornette's ideas fueled Train's 1965 recording, Ascension, an album-length composition for large ensemble. Ascension was a free jazz manifesto. Alice Coltrane.
It was such a freedom that he didn't limit the musicians to the former standards that we know of. They were given the freedom to play. Play your heart, play your soul, play from your spirit.
Although Ascension sounded completely free, Lewis Porter says there was a structure.
At that session, he had, for the group improvisations, which were interspersed with the solos, he had four scales that he actually conducted, and he verbally told the musicians, we're going to start with this scale. Now, when I give, I suppose, maybe a nod while he's playing the saxophone, maybe move the saxophone up, and you'll go to the next scale, then the next scale, and the next. There were four scales altogether.
We'll be right back. John Coltrane's Ascension, with his classic quartet augmented by saxophonist Archie Shepp, Pharoah Sanders, John Chikai, and Marion Brown, trumpeters Freddie Hubbard and Dewey Johnson, and bassist Art Davis. Ascension was a clarion call for free jazz, drawing musicians to this new sound. You're listening to part two of A Portrait of Saxophonist John Coltrane on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. As conventional structures fell away, John Coltrane's solos became longer and longer, exploding on a chord-free, rhythm-free landscape. Coltrane would frequently take off in spontaneous duets with drummer Elvin Jones.
We played a club in Philadelphia called, it was called East Showboat, yeah. And this particular Saturday, something happened to John's horn. You know, he couldn't get any sound out of it until, you know, only these high squeaks, sort of. And he just kept playing. He just kept blowing into the horn until the sound came back. McCoy dropped out. Jimmy Garrison dropped out. And so it was just the two of us playing. We played that piece for 3 hours.
Alice Coltrane.
One Saturday night, they played so well, they played so long, that when we came out, the dawn was beginning to break. And I heard some people, oh, what, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock? I have to get ready. I'm not going to have enough time to sleep. I have to go to church. So her friend said, you already went to church. So you don't have to.
The John Coltrane Quartet, playing after the crescent. With each recording, Train's compositions became more like emotions and moods, typified by the 1965 album, Om. The title was derived from a Hindu expression of all-encompassing spiritual power. Alice Coltrane.
John was telling everyone to identify with Om. This primal, universal sound. So, if this is an original first sound, let us all try to blend toward it. Let us all try to gravitate toward it and then play it through our instruments.
I am he who awards to each the fruit of his action. I make all things clean. I am Om. Om. Om.
On recordings like Om, Train continued bringing extra musicians into the group, including saxophonist Pharoah Sanders and drummer Rashid Ali. Some nights, he'd invite other players right up from the audience. These expanded ensembles weren't easy on members of the original quartet.
Albert and I think so we were self-sufficient. We didn't need all these people, but we respected him, so whatever he wanted to do was fine.
McCoy Tyner.
I think one of the things that made me decide that I should move on was We were at the Village Gate, and Norman Simmons was playing opposite with Carmen McRae opposite the band. And Norman came up. He says, "You know, F sharp is really out of tune." And I said, "Really? I could hear it because we had the two drummers, and they were, you know, obviously it was very hard for me because I couldn't hear the piano, you know, the two drummers."
And one of those drummers wasn't happy, Elvin Jones.
The group harmony was gone when that started to happen.
A few months later, John Coltrane reflected on the departure of McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones.
The thing I wanted to do in music, see, and I figured I could do two things. I could have a band that played like the way we used to play, mm-hmm. and a band that was going in the direction that this, the one I have now, is going. I could combine these two with the, you know, with these two concepts going. I believe it would have worked, but. You know, Elvin and McCoy, they couldn't hold it. It was time for them to go.
After Elvin Jones and McCoy Tyner left, Rashid Ali occupied the drummer's chair, and Alice Coltrane took Tyner's seat at the piano. To the uninitiated, this edition of John Coltrane's group was a firestorm, a chaos with no center. But Coltrane biographer Lewis Porter heard a musician reaching a new plateau.
He's working on a sound that's unlike any sound he'd used before. It's a beautiful, lush sound with a big vibrato. It's a very different sound, for example, than you would have heard 6 years before, 7 years before on Giant Steps' album. So he's very, very intensely working on his music in particular directions.
John Coltrane in a duet with drummer Rashid Ali. Train persevered in his music against withering criticism, but other concerns were coming into play. He began suffering the onset of liver cancer and was constantly tired, but he continued to play and record, leaning on saxophonist Pharoah Sanders more and more as his energy waned.
It helps me stay alive sometimes because I find that physically, man, the pace I've been leading has been so hard. I feel that I like to have somebody there if in case I just can't get that strength. I like to have the strength in that band, you know, from somewhere.
By the time Coltrane's liver cancer was diagnosed, it had progressed too far for an operation. He played his last date in Baltimore on May 7th, 1967. By Monday, July 17th, John Coltrane had died, just shy of his 41st birthday. John Coltrane's funeral at St. Peter's Church in New York City was attended by over 1,000 people. Saxophonist Albert Eiler and Ornette Coleman both played at the service, sending Train off to his next journey. At his death, Coltrane's quest for a music that merged sound and spirit seemed to have only just begun. But his legacy resounds years later. Every jazz tenor or soprano player has to stop at John Coltrane on the way to their own voice. Sonny Fortune was one of countless saxophonists influenced by John Coltrane and his great quartet.
He did it almost anything. I mean, Coltrane, many times I saw him, I thought the next thing he was going to do is throw the horn up in the air and see what that would sound like when he hit the floor or something. Because he did everything you could imagine on that instrument. But he did it with the foundation of a band that was right there all the time. Those cats were there all the time.
Alto saxophonist Jimmy Heath.
Train had a sound that nobody will be able to duplicate. It had his whole being involved in that sound, his whole love of music, his whole spirituality.
Whether playing one of his searing ballads or exploring melody at extreme angles, John Coltrane truly sought a universal sound that spoke in spirit to everyone. Writer Amiri Baraka.
What he changed essentially was he opened up the whole field in terms of where mainstream music could go. Because there wasn't people around like, you know, Albert Isla and Sun Ra and even Ornette to a certain extent, who were doing some out stuff. But what Train did is he wanted to take everybody with him. He was not just becoming a kind of solipsistic genius sitting there. He was trying to take everybody with him. And that's what I think is the grand, grand thing.
Alice Coltrane.
I believe that he was seeking some higher plateaus in music, beyond what we've seen, beyond what he had seen and heard, that he was constantly in experimentation, exploration.
Giant Steps and Beyond, Part 2 of our tribute to John Coltrane, was written, produced, and mixed by John DiLiberto. Jazz Profile's executive producer is Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith, senior producer Margaret Howes, website coordinator John Murph, administrative assistant Linda Browen. Special thanks to Kimberly Haas. Additional thanks to the Pacifica Radio Foundation Archives, Thurston Briscoe of WBGO in Newark, Jim Luce, Russell Westner, and Bruce Robinson. Further thanks to Terry Hinty of Fantasy Records, Chris Wheatley of Universal Records, and Jim Neal of Rhino Records. To email us, and for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org, or check us out at nprjazz.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, where jazz lives.
Discover more great jazz at NPR Music, including our new series, Live at the Village Vanguard, live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.